Welcome to HN Pod, your daily audio deep dive into the top stories, trends, and discussions from Hacker News. I am Sarah.
And I am Mike. Today is Monday, July 6th, 2026, and you are listening to episode 448. As always, we are looking back at yesterday's top posts. Today, we are covering the biggest stories from Sunday, July 5th, and we have a really fantastic lineup for you.
We sure do. Today, we will be looking at a completely free, privacy-focused offline maps app that the community is loving. Then we will talk about what sounds like the holy grail of office equipment, an open-source, repairable printer. After that, a fascinating deep dive into user interface design and what actually happens when you press a digital button too fast.
We will also be covering the EU Council's latest sneaky political maneuver to fast-track chat surveillance. And finally, a great piece on why the death of physical video games is not really about nostalgia, but a fundamental battle over digital ownership. Let us jump right in.
Our top story yesterday, pulling in over 900 points, is all about Organic Maps. If you haven't heard of it, Organic Maps is a privacy-focused offline maps and GPS app for hiking, cycling, and driving. It's totally free, has zero ads, no tracking, and it is powered by OpenStreetMap data.
What's really cool about this app is that it's designed to work 100% offline. You can download your maps, put your phone in airplane mode to save battery, and go on a week-long hike without sending a single byte of data to the network. They just hit 6 million installs late last year, which is a massive milestone for an indie open source project.
It really is. And looking at the Hacker News comments, it's clear why people love it. It's an antidote to the bloated, ad-heavy experience of Google Maps. But the discussion on Hacker News quickly turned to the ecosystem behind it. A user named Isa01 pointed out that Organic Maps is actually a fork of an older app called Maps.me, and now Organic Maps itself has been forked into a new project called CoMaps.
Right, the open source drama never sleeps. A commenter named Jump Crisscross explained that the CoMaps fork happened because of a disagreement over money. Organic Maps is technically organized as a for-profit entity, even though they rely on donations and grants, while CoMaps is strictly non-profit. It's a classic open-source fracture. As one user put it, the hardest thing about any software project is not the code, it's the interpersonal coordination and consensus.
Beyond the drama, there was a really interesting discussion about how these apps handle map data. Because they rely on OpenStreetMap, which is essentially the Wikipedia of maps, users can submit edits. But doing this offline is tricky. If you update a business address on Organic Maps while offline, how does it sync without conflicting with live data that might be weeks newer?
Exactly. Some users noted that Organic Maps often just creates notes on the map for other editors to verify later, rather than directly editing the live database. It is a delicate balance between trusting user input and preventing spam or accidental deletions. But overall, whether you use Organic Maps, CoMaps, or Osmand, the consensus is that having viable, community-driven alternatives to big tech navigation is absolutely vital.
Speaking of alternatives to big tech, our next story is about OpenPrinter, which got 711 points. This is a project aiming to build a repairable, compact, and robust printer designed to last. It features a refillable ink system, runs on open source components like a Raspberry Pi Zero, and operates independently of proprietary drivers using CUPS.
I have to admit, when I first saw this, my heart skipped a beat. We all hate modern printers. The DRM, the subscriptions, the refusal to scan if your yellow ink is low. OpenPrinter promises to let you use your black and color cartridges independently and refill them with bottled ink. But the Hacker News comments provided a very necessary reality check on how difficult this actually is.
Yes, the skepticism was high, and for good reason. A user named Hello Username brought up a great point from a previous discussion. They noted that inkjet printing requires orders of magnitude more engineering expertise and material science than most people realize. You are essentially trying to place microscopic drops of liquid ink onto commodity wood pulp with extreme precision, getting it to dry on the paper but not clog the nozzle, all under varying environmental conditions.
It is operating at the edge of chemistry and fluid dynamics. That is why OpenPrinter is not actually building their own printhead. If you look closely at their specs, they are using off-the-shelf HP cartridges. HP embeds the printhead directly into the cartridge, so OpenPrinter is outsourcing the hardest part of the engineering to HP, and essentially just building a very smart plotter to move the paper and the cartridge around.
Which is a clever workaround, but it opens up a massive legal and logistical can of worms. Commenters were quick to point out that HP could easily discontinue those specific cartridges or issue firmware updates to their cartridges to authenticate the printer. There is a sea of patents designed to inhibit exactly this kind of competition.
Though some legal nerds in the thread brought up the Supreme Court case Impression versus Lexmark, that case established that patent rights are exhausted by the first sale doctrine, meaning once HP sells you that cartridge, they cannot sue you for patent infringement for using it in a third-party printer or refilling it. But as one user noted, HP's lawyers will go broke trying to control everyone and everything. It is a David and Goliath situation, but I think we are all rooting for Open Printer to pull this off.
Moving on to our third story, we have a fantastic piece on user interface design from Marcin Wicari's blog titled, If You Are a Button, You Have One Job. It got 552 points. The author compares how the iPhone and Android-based Nothing Phone handle rapid button presses, specifically when rotating an image in the photo gallery.
It is such a small interaction, but it reveals so much about design philosophy. If you tap the rotate button on an iPhone quickly 8 times, the phone buffers those taps. It knows you want to rotate it 8 times, which is 2 full circles, so it just executes them sequentially. But on the Nothing Phone, if you tap the button while the first rotation animation is still happening, it just ignores the subsequent taps. It gives you haptic feedback, but does nothing.
The author argues this is a big deal because of a concept called situational disability, or what he calls situational power userness. If you are just casually rotating one photo, the Android way is fine. But what if you are scanning a batch of 50 documents and need to rotate all of them? You want to just tap 3 times fast and move on, not wait for a smooth animation to finish before the system accepts your next input.
The Hacker News comments had a field day with this. It comes down to a programming concept called debouncing versus buffering. Debouncing is when you ignore rapid repeated inputs to prevent accidental double clicks. Buffering is queuing them up. A user named M. Proud shared a legendary Steve Jobs anecdote. Jobs was doing a keynote demoing how fast PDF scrolled in a new version of macOS. He clicked the scroll button 2x by accident. The system buffered it, so he had to stand there on stage and wait for the document to scroll all the way down and then all the way down a 2nd time.
That is hilarious. Jobs actually saved it by telling the audience that even doing it 2x, it was still faster than the old operating system. But it highlights the danger of buffering. If a user thinks their click did not register, they might click 5 times, and suddenly the system executes 5 actions they did not want.
Exactly. The technical consensus in the thread was that if a button needs to debounce or wait for an action to finish, it must visually indicate that it is disabled. You cannot leave the button looking active but ignore the user's clicks. It breaks the trust between the user and the interface. Never force the user to wait for an animation to finish.
Trust is a great segue into our next story, which is decidedly about a lack of trust. With 418 points, we have an article from HiSea Online titled, EU Council Forces Chat Control Via Fast Track. This is a major privacy story. The EU Council is trying to push through a regulation to allow tech companies to scan private messages, and they are doing it right before the summer break to catch the EU Parliament off guard.
We need to clarify something important here that the Hacker News comments highlighted immediately. This is about Chat Control 1.0, not the infamous Chat Control 2.0. Chat Control 2.0 is the terrifying proposal that would force client-side scanning and effectively break end-to-end encryption on apps like Signal. Thanks to massive public pushback, version 2.0 is currently stalled.
Right. What they are doing here is fast-tracking the renewal of Chat Control 1.0, which is a temporary exemption that allows companies like Meta to voluntarily scan unencrypted or server-side messages for illegal material. That exemption expired in April, making those scans technically illegal under the EU's strict e-privacy directives. So the Council is using a procedural trick to ram a nearly identical proposal through as an urgent measure before lawmakers go on vacation.
The comments on Hacker News were deeply critical of this tactic. It is a blatant attempt to circumvent democratic oversight. But there was also a really chilling discussion about the reality of these scans. A user named Riedel shared a personal story from Germany. They found a link to some suspected illegal material on a random forum and reported it to the police online. Instead of a simple thank you, the police made them come into the station in person, gave them a stern lecture, and basically threatened them for being on that part of the internet.
That is wild. And the police officer openly admitted that they rely almost entirely on tech companies to send them automated reports with IP addresses to conduct raids, because local police do not have the resources to police the internet themselves. It shows how law enforcement has essentially outsourced surveillance to private platforms.
And that is why the principle of the secrecy of correspondence is so vital. As one commenter pointed out, we figured this out centuries ago with the Postal Service. It is illegal for the post office to open your sealed letters. Today, direct messages are our letters. Just because they are digital does not mean we should surrender the expectation of privacy. It is a story we will definitely keep our eyes on as the EU Parliament votes on it.
Our final story today comes from Popcar's blog, titled, "It is not about physical versus digital games, it's about ownership." It got 416 points. Recently, rumors and industry trends have basically confirmed that the next generation of PlayStation and Xbox consoles will likely not have disc drives at all. We are moving to an all-digital console future by 2028.
A lot of people brush this off. They say, "Who cares? I don't want plastic boxes cluttering my living room anyway." And they point to PC gaming, which has been almost entirely digital for a decade and is doing just fine. But the author makes a brilliant point. This is not about the physical disc. It is about Sony and Microsoft trying to completely kill the concept of ownership and the secondary market.
Exactly. When you have a physical game, you can lend it to a friend, you can sell it to a used game store, or you can buy it cheap at a garage sale. Console makers have always hated this. Every used game sold is money they don't get a cut of. If they eliminate the disc drive, you are forced into a walled garden. You can only buy games from the PlayStation Store at the prices Sony dictates, and you can never transfer that license to anyone else.
The author also tackles the PC comparison, which the Hacker News comments really expanded on. PC gaming is digital, yes, but it is an open platform. You have competing storefronts like Steam, Epic, and GOG. More importantly, you can strip the DRM from PC games. Commenters pointed out that with tools like the Goldberg emulator, you can bypass Steam's API and play your games completely offline forever. If Sony shuts down the PlayStation 6 servers in 15 years, every digital game tied to that console could just vanish. It is a nightmare for game preservation.
The discussion on Hacker News turned into a massive debate about regulation. A user named Jay Bombadil argued that this is one of the few areas where strict government regulation is necessary. They proposed a simple rule. Anything you buy must be your property. You must have the ability to transfer ownership, and a company cannot revoke your access later. If they shut down their DRM servers, they should be legally required to provide a DRM-free copy to paying customers.
Naturally, because it is Hacker News, that sparked a huge debate about free markets versus government overreach. But there was a surprising amount of consensus that digital rent seeking has gone too far. Whether it is John Deere tractors, Tesla software locks, or PlayStation games, consumers are getting tired of paying full price for things they do not actually own. It is a fight for digital consumer rights, and losing the disk drive is just the latest casualty.
It really makes you appreciate platforms like GOG that still sell DRM-free installers you can back up on your own hard drive.
Absolutely. Well, that is all the time we have for today's episode. Thank you so much for tuning in to HN Pod.
We hope you enjoyed diving into these stories with us. Make sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, and we will be back tomorrow with more of the top stories from Hacker News. Have a great day, everyone.